Just when you think you've already seen all the great Toy Story movies, they go and release another absolutely great Toy Story movie. And this, my friends, is a pretty great problem to have. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, I was quite pleased to have screenwriters Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom with me to chat about their latest film, Toy Story 4. This was such a fun chat because where else in the world can I geek out about Pixar development and filmmaking processes while also seriously discussing some smart existentialist character moments found within an entertaining family film? Clearly, this can only happen while discussing Toy Story 4, which is such a well-written film and a pleasure to watch that it really turned into one heck of a chat, so I know you'll dig this episode. But before we get into it, I hope you'll check out the 2020 ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship from ScreenCraft.org. They are now accepting applications, and the final deadline to apply is coming up. In fact, it is on February 29th, 2020, which happens to be the day of the leap year, so that's kind of easy to remember. Also of note, this marks the seventh year that the ScreenCraft Fellowship has helped over 100 emerging screenwriters launch their careers, and you could read all about them over at ScreenCraft.org. The way it works is up to four winners of the 2020 ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship will receive all expenses paid travel to Los Angeles for a week of meetings and mentorship with top Hollywood professionals. Past ScreenCraft screenplay competition winners have signed with top agents and managers and companies like CAA, 3Arts, UTA, Verve, Paradigm, Anonymous Content, and more. ScreenCraft winners have sold their screenplays and been hired to write for major studios including Universal Pictures, Netflix, and CBS, to name a few. Apply with your favorite feature or TV screenplay at screencraft.org/fellowship before the end of February 2020. And if you use code QAPODCAST at checkout, all one word, that's Q-A podcast, you'll save 10% on your application fee. And just so you know, the ScreenCraft team is already reading script submissions, so get yours in today and good luck. And speaking of things to dig, while you're surfing around online, I hope you check out the 1917 issue of Backstory Magazine. That's right, issue 40 has not one but four stories about 1917, which include interviews with the film's co-stars Dean Charles Chapman and George MacKay, also editor Lee Smith and co-writer Christy Wilson Cairns. There's a lot of stuff for you to explore in issue 40, which comes out in about a week, so I hope you'll check out the table of contents at backstory.net to see all the other great stuff that's inside. Remember, Backstory can be read on a desktop or laptop at backstory.net or via our iPad app or even Google Play for Android tablets, so thanks for checking us out. You can always grab a single issue on our site, or you can also use coupon code 1917 to save $5 off a one-year subscription on our site, so thanks for supporting my passion project. And folks, please remember this podcast comes right out of a free screening series here in Los Angeles, so if you'd like to attend a screening, you could sign up at backstory.net to get free invites and even bring a guest to one of my Q&A screenings, so sign up and I'll see you at the movies. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right on the stage at the Los Angeles Film School right after I introduce screenwriters Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom to chat about their latest film, Toy Story 4. Well, as promised, the only place to properly start would be with kids' questions. So if there's any kid in the house that has a question, I see someone in the back. Why did the ducky and his friend get pushed away from the carousel?
Well, the carousel goes around on these horses that are on big rods that go up and down. And those rods, when you go under the ride, poke down and up and down, and it just slammed into them. So it was an accident.
Very dangerous to go under a carousel.
Yeah, so that's...
It's a warning to all of you kids. I see another question. Why are Bunny and Ducky connected?
Because they love each other.
They're best friends.
They were sold together like they're best friends holding hands.
They come as a set.
And their names are Ducky and Bunny. You got their names right. So.
Do you have a question right here? Can you make another movie that never ends? Best question of the night. We hope so.
You don't work for Disney, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a plant.
All right, I see another kid question. An older kid, what are some of the movies that influenced you for Toy Story 4?
It's funny. I don't know if we looked at any specific I didn't. Did you?
We looked at The Wizard of Oz, just kind of look at like a road trip idea of it. And we also looked at It's a Wonderful Life, a little bit of like looking back on your life and what that means. But those were pretty much the main references.
And if you haven't seen them, you should see them anyway. So.
And then Toy Story 3 and 2.
Oh, that's true.
One.
Toy Story 1, 2, 3. Make sure we didn't repeat a gag.
Oh, so Toy Story 4 means that there were three movies before it. All right, just making sure. The kids' question section is over. Give it up for the kids that had the bravery to ask the questions. You know, as we're sitting here at the lovely Los Angeles Film School, it's always good to hear how people broke in and what your past is. Stephanie, to my knowledge, 2013, you ended up on the blacklist with 1969, A Space Odyssey, or How Kubrick Learned to Stop Worrying and Land on the Moon. Getting on the blacklist definitely changes a lot for people. How did it change your life, and what were you doing up until that point?
I'd been working various jobs. I'd been writing commercials and just doing various stuff just to pay the bills, a lot of copywriting. And
so with ad agencies?
Yeah, completely. And which actually is pretty good training for work in movies, actually, just having to go at that pace and turn things around that quickly. And then I was thinking that I was never going to get this writing career off the ground. And I was like, I'm going to have to move into my parents' basement. My parents don't even have a basement, maybe an attic. They don't have an attic. Oh, my gosh, I'm going to be homeless. And out of that frustration, I was like, I'm just going to write a script about everything I love, which was space and Stanley Kubrick. And I kind of took this angle of a female PR agent having to wrangle Stanley Kubrick to fake the moon landing. And I think because that came out of like such anger and frustration and things I actually loved, it actually hit a note with people and it got on the blacklist. And then from there, because I was on the blacklist and people have such limited attention spans, just because there's so much material out there, it got me to the top of studio lists, and executives read it and looked at it, and that got me meeting, and it got me on the water bottle tour, which is where you go to every studio in town and do a song and dance like, hi, this is me. This is the kind of stuff I like to write. And then from there, I got hired to do a couple studio assignments and then kind of ended up in the Disney family of it all.
Have any of the studio assignments gone through? Like, is anything getting close to production?
Well, I mean, I did a draft of Thor Ragnarok, which kind of led to the gig at Pixar.
Right, you were uncredited on Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah, and then I did that, which led to the gig at Pixar, and then I worked a little bit for Lucasfilm and
on Star Wars Resistance.
Star Wars Resistance, yeah. And right now, I've gotten into more TV, so I just did Lord of the Rings for Amazon Prime. And I'm a show.
And I'm there's some show, fans.
And I'm show running Paper Girls, which is a Brian K. Vaughan comic for Amazon Prime as well.
That's awesome. And when does the comic come out for Amazon?
We're gonna probably start shooting this summer, so we're looking probably at coming out next year.
That's awesome, Andrew. Obviously, Mighty Mouse New Adventures. Was
you're getting back to the Mesozoic era?
I'm going way back.
I think it's before Stephanie was born.
But that was an in for you, and it was TV animation.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I got a job right out of college at CalArts up here, coming out of animation, and Ralph Bakshi was getting into TV, and little did I know that the gang of us that did this just 3-4 month job on the New Adventures of Mighty Mouse was basically the people that would go on to do Simpsons and Ren and Stimpy and Batman and then for me Pixar. So it was a who's who when you look back. And then I was gainfully unemployed for many years after that.
Before how many years?
Pixar. 3.
Okay. Yeah,
which is very long when you're unemployed.
I hate to dwell on the darkness here, but it is difficult because the nature of the industry, it's like a roller coaster. There's so many ups and downs. You either have too much work to do or not enough. So how did you kind of keep in the game during those years and keep your wheels spinning?
Yeah.
Because, you know, some people give up, and you wouldn't be where you are today if you gave up.
Yeah, the lucky thing I did is I had 2 student films that were doing very well in the festival circuit. This is the late 80s when there was no such thing as an internet. You couldn't go to YouTube to watch any of these short things. And so the only way you could see a short animated or live action video was in a festival that would show it in a theater. And that's where Pixar and John Lasseter were showing the Luxo Lamp shorts. And the next one was called Red's Dream. And I got to know him through that festival circuit. And that's how my name was in the air when they suddenly went from the startup of 9 or 10 people to adding a couple more animators, and I was one of the lucky ones. So I was just the right place, right time. So it's always good to have your work out there, even if it's not being paid for. You know, it's just so people know you exist.
And just because this is Toy Story 4, what can you tell us about a fond memory from working on the first Toy Story, which you did?
It just makes me feel older than I want to, because I remember so well, like it was yesterday, what it was like to come up with those characters and finding their voices and finding that world. And it's like going back to a comfortable kind of class reunion, not with the people working on it, but with that world whenever we go back. I mean, it, not all films are like that. There's something unique about the Toy Story world where it always felt from the very beginning like we discovered a place that had more to it, that went beyond your periphery. And we found so much on the first movie that we couldn't put in the first one, and ended up using so much stuff that was discovered and talked about and theorized on the second one, and even some made it into 3. And of course, there's all this thinking that goes on with the other films. And so it really is like a land that you get to go visit. And every time you pick more corners and directions to go and find more.
I really enjoyed watching the bonus features on the Blu-ray and of this movie. And there was a moment where there's a license plate. And they say that the license plate was actually code that destroyed the movie Toy Story 2. By accident, and they had to go restore it from somebody's hard drive, which I think was a really strange fact. I'm just curious, was there ever that moment on Toy Story, the first movie, when you guys were pioneering so far, not just story-wise of what you were doing, but with the technology, where you weren't sure that it was going to come out the computer the way that you needed it to?
Maybe that was an everyday occurrence for the tech people, but I had been raised to ignore all the limits and just always press for more. What if we did this? What if we did that? So I was constructively ignorant about any limits. And so that we were always just shooting for the stars.
Before we get to this film, you're a part of what's known as the Pixar Brain Trust, which includes Brad Bird, Lee Unkrich, Pete Docter. That's 4 of you. If there's a dispute, aside from a thumb wrestling match, how do you guys win each other over, because there doesn't seem to be a swing vote?
It's not structured like that. It's not a voting system or that everybody has to agree. It never was. What it was a gang of people that bumped into each other and found that we jammed really great together, like a band, like a garage band. And we only had to give it a name once we got so large that there was more than one film being made at the same time. And so we just wanted the same voodoo of peer guidance that we just naturally did without anybody thinking it. There was no process on the first film. And so it's basically, the way I always put it is, we formed a band, let's call it the Beatles, and suddenly they said, great, you made a great first album, but the only way financially we can exist is if you make 4 albums, and you have to all individually make one so that we can make them in time. And we're like, well, the only reason that album was good is because we stayed together as a band. So we had to find a way to branch out and make more movies at once, but still use the chemistry of whatever made us good in the first place. And so we called it the Brain Trust, just so that there was some name to who had to get into the room to help get that mojo. But it's never been a judge and jury. It's never been in a voting system. It's just literally, how do we get that spark that happens when these people play in a room together?
There was a movie I saw a few years ago that I really liked. It was the end of a trilogy, or so we thought. Toy Story 3, it had a really good ending. People were kind of bummed, like, there's not going to be any more Toy Story. But to my knowledge, you're the one that was carrying the torch, that there was still more story to tell. So at what point did you realize that there's no reason you need to be locked in with the commonality of a trilogy structure, and that you could continue to make Toy Story movies?
The minute we thought of 3, I thought of 4.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not the whole thing, part and parcel. I mean, it was all these movies are like drawing blood and trying to like figure out how they work. But the idea that there was more to the world and more to be said, was always there. I had this epiphany after a 2-day retreat when we were trying to figure out what Toy Story 3 should be. And what broke me out of it and got us to the whole thing of like, what if we stop being scared of time, like literal time, and let Andy go to college? And everybody laughed in the room and then kind of got sober and go, what if we did that? And we realized this is why we go to the movies. We go to the movies to be surprised. We go to the movies to like go places that we don't expect. In that same moment, I thought, what if these had been books that we had made? What if there were, it just was like this, which you're getting a peek at how weird my brain goes, but I'm like, what if these were existing children's books that we had always made these movies from? And then I imaged in my kids' room of like 3 red-bound books that were the Andy years and 3 red-bound books that were green-bound books that were the Bonnie years and 3 blue books that would be somebody else's. And I realized these toys, mixing and matching, could go forever with different kids and in different directions because the world's that grand and that broad and kids are that interesting and that different in ages and environments. And so the experience of what a toy could experience is infinite. When you just go with the truth of it, not trying to think of franchise, I don't think like that. I just think of like this place really exists. These toys really go through what we go through or what we think they might in our world. And it's infinite. I mean, I can keep thinking again and again of different kids that just I grew up with in my town, let alone the world. And that really just kind of broke it open and made me realize that we had to hand off to another kid. So the Bonnie handoff was always loaded.
The concept, and we're going to get to Stephanie's involvement in just a second, but the original concept, to my knowledge, was that Woody goes on a mission to specifically find Bo Peep in your early iteration, and she was missing from Toy Story 3. Was there any discussion during Toy Story 3 that she was missing for a reason? Because this movie opens with a prologue, and we'll get into spoilers later that shows why she's gone, but she was mysteriously kind of gone from Toy Story 3.
I wish we could take credit for having mapped that out, but no. No, I mean, there's nobody flying the plane, I hate to tell you. Like, there's just, you know, taking advantage of the jazz of it and going, oh, this is missing, let's go this way, and this is playing right now, let's follow that note. And we've always been like that. There isn't some big grand design, and there isn't some big cash grab. It's just literally us going, I keep using the musician analogy, but like, it's literally like, this is what seems to be speaking to us right now, and let's just run with it and see if it breaks or see if it keeps going.
Well, Stephanie, as an outsider coming into Pixar, you're exposed to a really unique process. And I'm just kind of curious how you came onto the project and what shape it was in when you came on and kind of what you noticed about their process.
Well, I came on, I was actually brought up to Pixar and I didn't know what I was meeting on. And I come into a room and it's Jonas the producer and it's Josh the director and it was Pete Docter and they're like, well, so it's Toy Story 4. I was like, and my reaction was the same as anyone's. Why are you making Toy Story 4? And what actually got me into it was one of your core ideas, which was that Woody's story isn't over yet. And that really was, I was like, this could be something really, really interesting. And I was like, well, what do you have so far? And like, well, we have quite a bit, but we're doing a reboot. We're putting that all aside, and we're going to kind of start from scratch and go back to Andrew's original treatment and really dig deep on what that is and what is there. And I was like, all right. I'm like, I'm in for this adventure because I've always wondered what happened to Bo Peep after Toy Story 3, and you're absolutely right. Like, Woody made a great sacrifice for his friends at the end of Toy Story 3, but he never got a real ending. His friends did. And I was like, this is going to be a fun exploration. And that's really what making movies is at Pixar. It's an exploration. Andrew summed it up perfectly. It's not like you go in with like a big game plan or you know exactly what target you're hitting. You just kind of have some broad arcs. And it's just literally like you get in there with the story artists and you just collaborate and try to figure out what the heck is this thing and what's going to hit those emotional chords the most.
At this point, you know, I'm just going to bring up that the story by credit for the movie has John Lasseter, Martin Hines, Rashida Jones, and Will McCormick as story by credit. So I'm guessing that was part of the earlier iteration. Was there any crazy left turns they took that you still respect that didn't end up in the movie, or elements you want to tell us about?
Well, I don't think there was anything that I would consider a wrong turn. It was just they went in a certain direction with the Bo Peep conceit of the world and with Woody that felt, when you look back, like, oh, it's still about a toy that loses another toy and goes to an antique store. But everything that was going under the hood was kind of not connecting, not flying, not going getting all the way to the end of the story the way you wanted it to. And to be fair, all of our films have that problem, and they take a very roundabout way of getting solved. But it just hit a real impasse. It just was not improving, and that's when you start to know something's got to sort of shake it up. And either it's start from scratch, like we did with Stephanie coming in, or sometimes it's other avenues of strategy. But I can't honestly, you might have a memory, but I don't remember there being anything that was radically off. I just think there was a lot of things that were sort of pausing and rethinking about what the point of the movie was and why made us sort of re-execute these scenes.
Yeah, I mean, when I came in, I never saw any scripts, but my first day, I saw the last reels that were, and there was just like seeds of great ideas that just needed some more connective tissue. And yeah, you guys threw me into the brain trust on my first day as well. And they were like, so we just showed you these reels, and what do you think? And I think that first brain trust, we really started drilling in. And going back to like your original idea of like, what does this mean? What does it mean to reconnect with Bo? And really drilling into like what Woody's purpose is now that he's lost his kid. And I think like we had, and it wasn't at that first brain trust, I think it was several brain trusts later, we really keyed into this idea of all these characters are dealing with redefining themselves and loss. Like Bo Peep has suffered a loss, Woody has suffered a loss. I mean, even Forky, he's lost his identity as being a fork and he's trying to figure out who he is. And it's like, what do you do when the world hands you an unideal situation? And how do you define yourself in a way that can be better?
How do you adapt?
How do you adapt? Exactly.
I mean, the broad strokes of it, you get lost in the woods on every movie when you're trying to create somebody from scratch, characters from scratch, world from scratch. You don't know what's wrong and versus right. I mean, anything could be useful. And we went lost in the woods for a very long time. We're talking years till we figured out who Woody was and Buzz were for the first movie. And the truth is, it took until Stephanie got on for us to finally start focusing more, and we don't know who Bo is, and we don't know who Gabby Gabby is. And I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I feel like the bulk of what you gained ground on was figuring out who she was, and so that we could then figure out, well, how does that work for Woody's story? And you can't figure out Woody's story if we don't have Bo figured out. I'm simplifying, but I think that's really what ended up being the gained real estate that you realize, oh, there was no fast way to solve that.
Just because we're in the non-spoiler section for a moment, I just want to remind people of the intense logistics of making a Pixar movie. You guys do what's known, you referred to it as reels a second ago, but eventually you do an animatic of the whole movie, which is just kind of rough drawings with temporary sound to get through an iteration. How many animatics fully would you say of the movie from beginning to end there were during this period? And am I right that the period of making Toy Story 4 was about 5 years?
5 years is the longest we usually take. The shortest is maybe 4. So it's not a big difference. But
it felt like 100.
Yeah. Well, so how many full iterations of the movie? Because you kept changing.
Typically 6 to 7 versions of the movie go up.
Would you say that's right for this?
Might have been more.
Might have been more? Okay.
But, I don't know.
10 seems like a right number.
Might be.
And in that same level, how many iterations of your screenplay would you say that you're
every,
like
every
a
time
new
you,
draft.
Every time you put it up, it's a draft.
It's a draft.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So 10 drafts technically.
Yeah. I mean, the best way, if I don't know if anybody understands theater, but like when you workshop a play in theater,
right.
you're putting it up on its legs knowing that it's not even a dress rehearsal. It's like I'm going to just see with chairs and tables and actors in their clothes what it feels like to see my play put up, and then I'm going to purposely rewrite based on what I discover. That's what we do. We workshop the play every 4 months of what we have, knowing it's not going to work, knowing it's not good enough, but to inform us, because there's a certain part of your brain that doesn't give lets you have access to it until you're performing in front of an audience with your pants down, you know, and you suddenly go, oh, now I realize this doesn't work, this isn't funny, or we need something here. And we do that, every 4 months.
It is a high artistic luxury to have. I mean, there's a lot of people that are jealous that have tried to emulate the Pixar process because you are able to make scratch versions of your film really until you get it right, until you're happy with it, and change midstream if you need to.
The other thing we don't do that people think we do because of this term brain trust is that we committee how to solve it once we have... You know, we'll have an assessment period where we all look at what we have, and everybody will throw in their 2 cents. But at the end of the day, it's the filmmaker's decision what to do with those notes, whether they take them or not. And because we're firm believers that you have to have a singular vision to like get it to the screen. So.
And that's a huge luxury because you're getting story input from actual storytellers that are just at the top of their game. And then you get to decide whether or not that's right for the story you're telling. I've never experienced anything like that before or since, and it's a beautiful process.
It's messy, but it...
Oh, it's very, very messy.
But it works.
But it really does work. The other thing that Pixar has the luxury of, which I think is incredible, and I don't know why other studios haven't adapted a little more, is you have an entire story department. And, you know, the story department informs on all movies. You have both artists and development, dramaturgies, to use your theater term again. Talk about your integration with the story department and how it works, because the weirdest thing about these animated movies is there is a chicken before the egg element in which certain teams are building sets and some character models before the script is actually done, but they have a sense of the scene. So just give us some of that, because keeping all that straight in your mind, I think is something that a lot of other screenwriters don't have to go through unless they're on a Pixar movie.
Yeah, I mean, I loved working with our story team. They were amazing and just so willing to just go on to crazy lark and go down these crazy avenues of things that may or may not work. And our head of story, Val, was just so invaluable in helping really shape who Bo Peep is and where she was going with all that. I mean... It was amazing to be able to just write a scene and then hand it off to these board artists, and they do just the rough animatic of it, and you kind of like, you read the script as they kind of scroll through the drawings, and it's beautiful to see how they plus everything that you did, and then seeing that makes you go, oh, if we added this line here, if we did that there, that could be a little bit better, and it is like writing jazz. It's the ultimate form of collaboration. To instantly visually see what you've written in a way and be able to riff off of that is a great luxury.
The flip side of that can be, I mean, the plus is obviously you're thinking visually right away. You're not thinking words. But the downside is that because it's suddenly realized and you can look at it and think of it like a finished film in its conceit, is that somehow it becomes a little more precious and you don't want to change it or you start working with it thinking it shouldn't be as easy to change as retyping a sentence. But it has to be. It has to be just as throwaway as anything else.
Well, and I think that's kind of the job of the writer at Pixar. I mean, you and I kind of became a little bit of story police. You know, and it was a little bit of like, I'm sorry, I know this looks really, really cool, but it doesn't add up to this that's going to happen in Act 3, so we got to kill it.
That's tough. I mean, I guess talking about your creative habit for a second is another thing I'd love to know, is how important is outlining to your process? I mean, it's strange on these movies where sometimes literally your day's work is to fix just a scene, but you're still compiling this entire screenplay. But do you still consider yourself to be outlining during this process?
Outlining is just part of my writing process. I'm a crazy outliner. And Andrew is as well. So that worked well.
Andrew, were you continuing even after the treatment to break it down into an outline before scripts were coming in?
I don't think any of the movies that at least I'm aware of at Pixar have ever had the same path in how they got from start to finish, like at all. So the path of this one was very unique. It's if there was any similarity, it was similar to Toy Story 2 in the sense that like it went wholesale one way and then we realized the wrong way, slam on the brakes, and went a whole nother way, but basically using the same conceits of almost the outline of what if this happened here and that happened here, like back of the DVD box kind of general paragraph. And the way Steph and I never, I never worked together as writers, what I was playing executive producer coach through all of it, checking in and kind of just being, in a weird way, just the Toy Story tone police. Like, I have this big thing, like, the world of Toy Story is not little people with little suitcases and little hats going to little mouse holes. Like, it's not that. They are, I said, they're lading the tramp rules. They live in our world, and when we're not in the room, they're bored like jury duty with nothing to do, right? and their problems are real problems, like somebody closed the closet door on them and they can't get out for the rest of the afternoon. That's their problems. Like, it's not little people doing little people things. And you'd be amazed how many people with really clever ideas that are very smart thought like that, and I had to kind of come in and police that a lot. But that's where I remember spending most of my time. What really happened with Stephanie and I was that she kind of, it was almost like a relay race. Like, she had it for a very long time. And then it got to a place where, and this happens on every film, everybody got lost in the woods because they were so involved in it. And everybody had a piece of being correct and a piece of being wrong because you're in the woods and you can't see objectively. And I was outside of the woods and I said, you know what? I'm not going to go in there because I'm going to get lost with you guys. How about, you know, I, for a limited period of time, help you guys. Give me where you're at. I'll go away. Stay out of the woods. I'm going to rewrite this thing with everything you've got. So that it makes sense to me, knowing that it will probably be wrong, and I'm going to hand it back to Stephanie, and then she's going to suddenly be able to see it with objectivity that she's lost for being in the woods. Because I know that's happened to me on every one of my films, and that's why I always write with a writing partner, because of exactly that. And that's what we did. Yeah. And then it went back to you, and then it kind of became this.
Then we pulled you into the woods.
You know, but that I was really, truly like, if I grab you, you're going to pull me into the quicksand kind of equivalent. And I'm like, no, I don't want to even hear the thoughts about what you guys have. Just give it to me clean, you know.
When you sit down to write and you're doing a draft, do you prefer to work for a certain amount of hours, or do you like to work for a certain amount of pages per day?
I don't think it's that mathematical. I think that it's more, I mean, very often when you're under a deadline, it's like, what do I have to get done in order to get to the next piece kind of thing. And also it's a lot of just, I work more on like character arc. So I'm like, okay, like these sequences will kind of like pay off into this character arc. And I can kind of see like how this little chunk is going to work really, really well together. So I'll go with just that sequence and just write that. There's no like real major game plan where I'm like, I'm going to get my 5 pages done today,
because that's cool.
That sets myself up for failure.
There's no one way to do it. Andrew?
Oh, don't ask me.
No daily page count, no daily hours.
I'm on year 30 now of writing, and I'm just like, I still am trying to figure out how I write. Like, what my
was there anything that was different or unique or unusual about on Toy Story, the way that you were writing that maybe has already changed?
The original?
No, this one.
This one. This one just showed that I've actually learned something over the years, because I'd never had to do it under such an extreme deadline.
How extreme? I
did it in like 5 weeks, I think.
Yeah, no, we were on a time crunch.
Yeah, wow. So it was like how fast.
So we were all going.
So how fast could I like hold myself in a room, have food thrown under the door, and just, you know, try to get it back into alignment? And
wow.
I could have, honestly, I'd say even 10 years ago, I couldn't have done that. I think that's just experience over time. And I could have never done that probably still now if it weren't for a Toy Story movie, because I
lived with it
so much. I spoke the language. And I think that gave me an advantage. I think you'd have to double that number at least if I were to ever have to do that for anybody else. So it was just one of these rare things where I was probably the right guy to be able to help them solve it in an impossible amount of time, you know. So,
what do you do about writer's block if you get it?
I don't have it.
Really? That's great.
I just make myself write badly. Like what I don't do is stop writing. I don't stop writing.
Progress versus perfection.
Exactly. Yeah.
Stephanie?
I don't get writer's block either. I just keep going, and sometimes it's not going to be that great, and that's what rewriting is for. Yeah.
You know, some people consider these movies almost sandbox in their ways, like the sandbox feel in which you create a world and then you could play creatively within it. And one of the things that's interesting, especially for the Toy Story movies, is you take us into these weird places of the real world that we don't often see. So underneath the carousel, behind the walls where the electrical cords are plugged in.
And you're speaking my language. I would come in and probably very loud and red in the face and just say, you don't need all this spectacle. It's just being behind the cupboard or under the carousel is amazing enough.
So do you sometimes figure out those locations? Sorry to interrupt. Do you sometimes figure out those locations early on before you're even sure what the plot points are going to be?
No, it's just more like the opposite. Like take a breath, pause, and just go, what's right in front of us that's a perspective that we've never considered that's always been there? Because that's going to make you go, oh, wow, that feels like the world of toys, which is kind of close to the world of pets.
You know? It's just great because there's so many great moments, you know, ranging from them just on top of the cupboard, looking at all the sunlight coming in through the different chandeliers, to the pegs of the carousel horses going up and down as a danger point underneath.
I mean, I know one of the biggest things I cracked was just the very opening of the film.
You mean the prologue?
Yeah, I can't even say it was logic. I mean, there was always a prologue. But I realized I felt that it wasn't even an external thing for the audience. It was almost an internal thing for people inside Pixar, because I realized there were generations of people working there that had never been on the original. And I said, you know, the original was built on just the mundanity of toy life. And I thought about it and I said, you know what? When you add the three movies together, 1, 2, and 3, it's about 5.5 hours of screen time, and out of that, maybe half of it spent in normal life with a toy. Those toys have had 9 years of just commonplace in the house. There is so much interesting stuff to real estate to grab of just regular toy life, and we've forgotten about this. We've ended in an airport and then ended in an incinerator and like gone to like these huge things that could easily fall into the trap of you've got to top yourself every movie, as opposed to, let's just go back to basics, and a toy's been left in the backyard, and let's just live with what it was like to be a toy every day, and Woody's necessary role, and Bo's in a regular, and that the power that was in the mundane. And that I felt really kind of got everybody out of their spectacle thinking, and just kind of got back to just, it's, like I said, it's just lying right in front of you, just the power and charm and charisma of just being in the small with an everyday event.
And I think that's what has worked so great about a lot of your writing is the power of the simplicity of broad brushstrokes. You know, it's very clear. Stephanie, was there an epiphany of a location that you remember having an insight on?
I think that like the biggest location for me was just really taking that carnival sequence and using that as a way to show how Bo's life in the playground was so different than Woody's, and showing what a toy's life could look like outside of a room in a location where you don't normally see toys. That was the biggest challenge with that, and just showing like how you wouldn't be like, no, there's no way like a toy could go through unseen through that was the biggest challenge of those locations.
So the schedule was about 5 years. What would you say the budget is? What's the reported budget?
Oh God, I have no idea.
Okay,
it's a lot.
It's a lot. It's just
we don't make cheap movies.
No,
I know that.
No, it's an expensive process. Well, we're gonna get into our spoilers now, so we can talk in depth about the movie. Podcast listeners, if you have not yet seen Toy Story 4, I don't know what's wrong with you. Please go see it. Press pause. Come back. You know, diving right into the character of Bo, I think, is the place to go. What's to your benefit is that aside from her missing in the third movie, the character itself was not as defined in the previous two. Love interest was clear, those vibes were clear, but it, I think, left you a lot of freedom for the directions you go, which could be a blessing and a curse. So I'm curious, just some of the variants of like, okay, this Bo we were in love with for 5 months, it totally worked, but then we decided, no way, we had to reel it back. Tell us some of the places of exploration you went discovering Bo.
Well, I think Bo went from being very much like a traditional, like almost like princess kind of character, all the way to being like a dark pirate character, and somewhere in the middle was actually the real Bo Peep. And I think like really keying into like her backstory helped us a lot too, because she was a champion of Woody, but why was she such a champion of Woody? And why was she such a friend of Woody? And really this idea, which most of the original team didn't even know, that Andrew, I think you kind of had in the back of your head the entire time, that she was the leader of Molly, Andy's sister's room, and that they kind of came together as like two generals who had both understood what it meant to be the leader in their kid's room was really opening her up for us.
Yeah, they were equals. And I don't think I knew that all along, but I remember some meeting with us where we were like, oh no, that's exactly what it was kind of sitting there in plain sight all along. She was always running Molly's room from the first movie, but nobody had taken it one step farther until I think some meeting that we were in that where we realized, her day was Woody's, you know, but her version.
Yeah, and they could come together at the end of it and just be like, wow, that was like really tough, you know, like Buzz is bothering me again. And she's like, oh, the Barbies are really rough today. Like, you know, and they could really come together on that level.
Exactly.
And be each other's friends.
They're the only ones that understand exactly what the other one's really going through and being in charge of others.
Yeah.
Folks, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you about the 1917 issue of Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. That's right, issue 40 goes live in about a week and features not one cover story, but four cover stories about 1917, which include interviews with the film's co-stars Dean Charles Chapman and George MacKay, also editor Lee Smith and co-writer Christy Wilson Cairns. You could read Backstory on a desktop or laptop at backstory.net or via our iPad app or even Google Play for Android tablets. And if you'd like to subscribe, remember you could use discount coupon code 1917 to save $5 off a one-year subscription. Look, I really hope you give issue 40 a spin because it is packed with so many great pieces. You'll find an in-depth interview with Rian Johnson all about the twists and turns of Knives Out, and even a retro article with Rian Johnson about his debut feature, Brick. Writer-director Scott Z. Burns talks about his excellent political thriller, The Report. Charles Randolph discusses Bombshell. Screenwriter Anthony McCarten on The Two Popes, The Safdie Brothers on Uncut Gems, and so much more. We also interview comic book writers and novelists, and of course, more filmmakers behind 2019's top films and television, so I hope you'll check out the table of contents to see what's inside over at backstory.net and consider purchasing a single issue or subscription. Look, it really means a lot to me to have my podcast listeners support my passion project, so thanks for checking it out. And of course, while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll check out our sponsor's website today, screencraft.org. You know, their deadline for the next screenwriting fellowship is the last day of February 2020, and if you use code QAPODCAST, you could save 10% on your application. So I hope you support our sponsor at screencraft.org. But now let's jump right back into my conversation with screenwriters Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom about their latest film, Toy Story 4.
I'm curious because I've always wondered this. You know, he talks a lot about Andy, but as they verified in the movie that he was made in the 1950s, like Gabby Gabby, was there a character that you guys ever tried discussing before Andy? Because technically Andy would be the 90s.
As an owner?
Yeah, for Woody. Because if he was really around since the 50s, this boomer doll has seen some other Omers.
There is no hard, fast decision about what that was. I do remember talk about it being handed down by his dad.
Okay.
Who dad is and where dad comes from is up to you. But we did always feel that Woody was definitely a hand-me-down toy from somebody.
Okay.
And that it was within the family, so that he would have that blanky kind of attachment with Andy.
Just curious, because I mean, like, it's weird because they verified for sure that he's from the 50s, not just an emulation.
Well, and I think what we did lock in with his backstory and how that kind of relates to Bo is that he has never been without a kid or a place of being really well taken care of. And so Woody has a background in the toy sense of the world of privilege. So that coming up against Bo, who was literally a lamp, not really a toy, and she had a wonderful experience with Molly, she was thrown out and she was trash. And so kind of almost doing like a little bit of a class dynamic between them and their experience of what it is to be a toy.
With Bunny and Ducky as well, because they were stuck on a wall for years and hadn't had a kid. And they were in games that were rigged where they said they wouldn't be won.
Yeah, their whole view of the world is through a carnival. I mean, you know, they're essentially bait for kids. That's dark.
Yeah, that is dark. I'm curious at what point you realized that it was going to be a coming-of-age story kind of for Woody in the sense that his loss of purpose, you know, essentially emulating an empty nester, which are tropes that we've had before of kids growing up, and then we've seen that for him the toy life recycles. There's always a new kid, generally he's passed down or something. But this is new territory.
Well, that was really where I came in on the sort of intervention for about 5 weeks, was going, what is this story? Who is it? What are we saying about Woody that's different here? And I realized, oh, we've always, whether by design or by happenstance, have fallen into the truth of what's really going on with us in life. And that's the huge plus about this particular world, is that we can embrace the actual calendar time that has passed between movies. And we did that between 2 and 3. We actually embraced the 13 years that had passed,
right,
with Andy, and went to the truth of what, how life moves and shifts, and all the rules kind of bend or shift or evolve. And that never stops. And I think that was the big epiphany for me in my life between 3 and 4, those 9 years, was, oh, there's still another chapter. It doesn't just end with Empty Nest. It's now, in a weird way, 3 is more like looking back and going, how do we let go? And 4 is, how do you look forward and go, what's next? What do I do when none of the things that I've used before to define myself are playable anymore? And realizing that there was a toy analogy to that was going on naturally with him in Bonnie's life, or that we could shift it to embrace that. Leaning into the truth of that nexus between Empty Nest and pre-grandparent, you know?
Right. But it's something that the other movies haven't explored, which is why this film still felt very fresh.
Yeah, because it's leaning just into the truth of time.
Yeah. Was there ever a chance of Forky being called Sporky, because it is a spork, technically?
Do you want to get into the Sporky of it all?
I think it's literally legal reasons.
It was literally legal
really?
Reasons.
Oh, that's fascinating.
The name Sporky was copywritten.
Right.
And so we had to have it be Forky.
That's fascinating. You know? Okay.
And it actually works, because given Bonnie's age. And
it's funny.
She doesn't know what a spork is.
Right.
So.
Well, how about this? When did the concept evolve of using a toy that was not traditionally manufactured and sold in a toy store, but rather something that Bonnie assembled?
Forky started out as a gag.
Yeah,
that I think
one-off.
Predates you.
Yeah, it was a one-off gag.
It was a one-off gag.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I think it was a year before you came on, where Brad Bird in one of our branches meetings says, like, I don't know what it is, but there is gold in those hills for Forky. and he was right. Like, there was such, you know, totally, it's almost like the entire universe forced us to start putting him into the center of the eye of the storm, or the nucleus of the atom, and just like realize, oh, he really should be at the center of this, because it represents so much.
Well, you can talk about the internal struggle in a way that's fun. Yeah.
Well, but here's the payoff for it all, because exposition is so difficult for writers. But the exposition that you have of Forky and Woody walking down the highway is like almost existential. Like, he's explaining life to this 2-day-old toy and his views of it. And you see his views kind of shading away, like, because he's accidentally mentioning Andy rather than Bonnie.
And I think the power of that scene is greater than you think, because you are unconsciously imbuing 3 movies worth of experience that you know is coming out of Woody's mouth when he's talking to this guy. So this sense of apprenticeship and passing it on has all this weight and depth in it that you couldn't get from a singular movie. That's something else we could take advantage of.
We really leveraged everything we could for that one.
It was perfect, though.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. You know, lost concepts always fascinated me. On the Blu-ray, there was a lost scene of the antique store when Woody first encounters Bo Peep. And she is literally gambling in a hungry, hungry hippo game in the back of the store at a place you guys called Toy City. And she's cheating, by the way.
I'm already getting angry. Like, Toy City, I hate that.
Yeah.
It's little people with little hats and little mouse holes.
Well, so tell us about that and finding the perfect meetup, because what you did in the movie, again, was you're using all these decades of the rules, which is that when humans are around, toys are blank-faced. They're not dead, but they're just lifeless. And only when the humans are not looking in their direction do they come to life. So the perfect meetup was a random child that just happened to have Bo Peep in her hand and Woody, but they couldn't communicate to each other in that moment. So talk about like the math behind finding that perfect moment when you were starting at the Hungry Hippo gambling.
Well, I mean, Hungry Hippo Gambling came before me.
I was going to say, that Stephanie's a result of Hungry Hippo. That was just the wrong way to go. And
it's fascinating and fun to watch.
But. No, I feel like that moment came because I was some of my favorite movies, the romantic parts of them are when you have that beautiful moment where you're looking across the person that you have so much you want to say and so much you want to connect with across the dance floor, and you just can't get to them. And so it was kind of embodying that romantic moment in a total toy fashion.
And drama is tension. And what's more tense than finally seeing somebody that you never thought you'd see again and you can't say something.
Yes, and you're play acting with them in the role that you want nothing more than to talk to them in.
It's a perfect moment, and then you know we almost find out that she's now become like Mad Max Furiosa. You know she's got a skunk mobile and she's riding around.
I remember also the room we were in when I get my dates all wrong, but I always remember who was in the room and when we were like, oh no, she's figured out is that I'll play with the kids I want. I'm gonna figure out a way that I can choose who I play with when I want to versus the other way around. It's no longer being the victim. Now she's gonna lead.
Right.
And what does that mean? And what are the consequences for that, both physically and emotionally? That's just in that moment, everything. I just felt like the whole world opened up for how interesting Bo could get.
Completely. And the fact that she's willing to put herself on the line like that when she's made of porcelain as well, and just like the care she actually has to take in those play scenarios while still being tough, was a really beautiful way where you could explore just, being tough but still having that vulnerability.
Right. I think it's always interesting to hear about like kind of left turns and lost scenes. That's why I always watch the deleted scenes on a Blu-ray first. But I'm curious if there was anything that wasn't put out. Just an idea that you guys were fixated on that was fun for a while, and it was either going to be too time consuming or was too much of a stray from the story that you'd like to tell us about in the 10 animatics that you guys went through.
Dancing Santa?
That's on the Blu-ray as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm responsible for Dancing Santa.
Santa was always funny. That's why I kept coming back in.
I tried to kill Dancing Santa, but yeah.
It was just a character in the antique store that tells them which way somebody went.
Yeah, I created my own monster with that one because it was funny, and then it was just, it went nowhere.
That's the particular trap of working on the Toy Story movies is there's so many intriguing and often funny avenues to go down that plays with toys and the conceits of toys. And they seduce you into thinking that they should stay in the film for much longer than
it was a good way to handle exposition because he was giving them exposition, but they had set off his motion detector, so he had to dance while he was telling them things.
Yeah, and
which was funny.
And he was giving them dark warnings while he was playing Jingle Bell Rock.
What was his French Canadian name that got them confused? It was Bo.
Oh yeah.
Beau de Lamp.
Beau de Lamp.
Yeah,
Beau de Lamp.
Beau de Lamp.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to talk about the thematic of Inner Voice because it's really fascinating how you're looking at the physical voice of Woody's voice box and then Buzz listening to his inner voice and trying to be guided by it and understanding that. And then the giving up of the voice box to Gabby at the end is fascinating. So when did those kind of elements coalesce? Because the fascinating thing is that there's actually not a consequence really to give up your voice box other than you just might not be appealing to a child, but you could still communicate with the other toys.
Well, it was the only thing that really felt like a true sacrifice that identified Woody, even though he never used it much.
You all
just felt it. Like if you gave that up, like you are permanently agreeing to never be who you were.
To never be with a kid again, essentially.
And that was just the power of it. So, and then the Buzz inner voice thing was, he just had always been, there's always just been sort of this invisible or unsaid promise that Buzz would be deranged some way in each film, and we had to find another way. And I didn't want to do it gratuitously, but it started out gratuitous. Just to sort of force it.
Really?
But
What were some of the other ways it was gratuitous?
Well, no, it was gratuitous initially with just doing the inner voice thing.
Right.
There were also iterations before that, too, that were crazy. And then going down this road as well.
But everybody knew that, like, this has to have a purpose at some point. But, there's a lot of patience to just see if it finds a home. And so it ultimately found that wonderful wrap-up at the end. But that's another luxury for working 5 years on something, is there are some things where you just, your spidey sense says, this is leading somewhere we don't know yet, but let's not throw it away yet. And half the job through the early years is discerning what's something that should stay and wait until it grows into something that may become a rose, and what's just a weed.
You know? Right. And keeping track of all that must be just really difficult.
You make a lot of mistakes confusing a rose with a weed.
Well, and again, on the voice thematic, you actually went for one of the rare rules of the Toy Story universe, in which Buzz actually speaks in his own voice in a series of inner voice monologues, reminding Bonnie that she's forgotten something. And I'm just curious, was there a big debate about that? Because I know it's something that rarely happens.
Huge debate.
Well, but I like wouldn't listen to it because I was like, I was there when we came up with Sid being talked to, and I'm like, we've defined that rule. That rule exists. We're going to use it once, and we're going to use it for a crucial moment here.
That was the only thing that won the argument. Like, you so artfully debated that, and you were like, it was done in Toy Story 1, and it's the rule of the world. And everyone was like, oh, okay.
Let's talk about Gabby for a second, though. Gabby, because... She is sold initially as an antagonist. And this is a movie where really, it's interesting, time is almost the antagonist. And it's more of a character transformation, because once we get to know her, although she seems scary and the ventriloquist dummies around her also seem a little threatening, she really, you totally turned it around. And it could have been this forceful removal of the voice box, but really they talk it out in language that Woody... is drawn to and lives as, it's his code. It's the code of the kind of warrior he is. So tell us about that iteration, and were there other ways that she coerced it out, or was she really just a false antagonist from the start?
Well, when I came on board, she was very arch, and there was no redemption there at all. And what I found really interesting was just kind of like this idea of, once again, like, Bo Peep didn't come from a life of luxury like Woody did either. And I was like, well, what if our villain also didn't have that luxury either? And it was even worse than Bo Peep, that she wasn't only thrown out, she never, ever got a chance with a kid because she was a factory defect. And so she never got that moment with a child the way that Woody had, or even Bo Peep had.
Yeah, and once we did come up with her revealing to have good intentions and using her for good instead of evil by the back end, it made us go back and make sure everything that she said and the tone that she said it in was never anything bad or Machiavellian or evil, and that it was really just our projecting a bad first impression.
That's right.
On
yeah.
her.
Because I've seen more than once, and like when you watch her dialogue, you know, even when she talks to the ventriloquist, she's like, you know, 50s etiquette of stop them, please. You know, like she's asking please.
She's just a creepy doll, and we can't help
but
like...
And she was just made that way.
Right.
judging her, you know.
I guess previous voice box territory for you, the most obscure that I could think of was the penguin in Toy Story 2.
Wheezy.
Was it Wheezy? Wheezy?
Wheezy.
Wheezy. I always forget that. It had a broken voice box that was fixed so Wheezy could sing at the end. Was there any rules or inspiration from that came into play here about how to handle voice box issues?
No. You're the first person to connect all those dots.
Sorry. I have too much time on my hands. I'll tell you dots that I love. It's our good friends up north, the Canadians, and Duke Kaboom was just amazing. There should be shrines to Duke Kaboom. What I love about it was that you used him as a vehicle story point, right? On a mission movie, there's always somebody that's going to get you from point A to point B. They've either got the ride, they've got the knowledge, something. So you're using Duke Kaboom in that capacity, but then you were turning it on its head comedically, in which he has this horrible Boxing Day experience with his child. Tell us how that came into play after you realized you were going to use this Canadian Evel Knievel doll.
That's Josh.
Yeah.
That is Josh Cooley through and through. That's he was the secret weapon on many other films for gags and left off center thinking like that. And so he's kind of a fountain of that stuff. And you know, we just learned to like not be seduced, like I said earlier, about how funny everything that he would suggest was, and go, well, that worked. And Duke just was $1 million the minute he was thought of, even in versions of the movie that didn't work.
Well,
so Duke always stayed alive.
And when I came on board, he was actually wasn't in it anymore. And we were in the story room, and there was this picture of like this Evel Knievel character that our story artist Eric Benson had done. And we were all, I was like, wait, what is this? And then Josh just started riffing on it. And I'm like, why isn't this in the movie? I'm like, put him back in immediately.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Duke was the man. And obviously Ducky and Bunny, who we talked about a little earlier with the kids, were great. But again, it's funny because like mission movies sometimes have serious consequences or serious moments. But here, they're just trying to figure out how to get the key. And you have them concoct this plush rush concept that's used later, and the chicken dinner winner.
That's Carrie Hobson, and that is to me one of the Hall of Fame gags of all of our movies.
It was great,
and that came wholesale from her. And again, this is the luxury of having kind of like a staff of writers or a staff of story people that are always thinking cinematically and comedically. Is that you get this embarrassment of riches, and if they come at the right time when the rest of the film's working, you can use so much of it. And when they come early, they just confuse you, you know. But that was another moment where you're like, just put it in and don't fuck with it.
Well, aside from just being a hilarious gag, you also used it in the end when Gabby finds, you know, the lost child. You know, they did the baseball out again. But I'm curious on that moment before. You have Gabby fail. Like, her whole character goal was to get that voice box, and she thought that she would have that specific child fall in love with her, and she didn't. And it could have been a shorter movie, and I thought that the length of the movie was perfect, by the way, but in the way that people always try and cut things, I'm curious when you decided.
Woody had to experience, Woody and Beau and the basically the new team, which is Duke and Bunny and Ducky Bunny, had to experience, and we, the audience, had to experience what it was like to get a toy back to a child besides their own agenda, so that you and they would feel the thrill of what they're meant to be doing next.
Right.
Completely. And I think also it was important for Gabby's character arc, because it just showed that her thinking was wrong, because it was the whole idea like, oh, if I just get fixed, a kid will like me. And it's not just about being fixed and someone will like you. You don't have to be perfect to be loved. And I think getting that in there was really important to show that you can have everything that's absolutely like the best outfit, the best accessories and everything, but that's not necessarily going to get you the love you need. It's being there for the person at the right time and actually being of service and be of help.
Yeah. It was a great moment because it shows like, it's not always so easy,
yeah.
You know, because she was just convinced that was the one thing that she needed.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a brilliant moment. Finding the ending to something like this is difficult. And again, on the Blu-ray, there's an ending called the She's the One ending, which was at some point an iteration, which had Bo Peep finding a girl that seemed like needed her. Mm-hmm. And rather than going off with Woody or even, you know, daring to say it's okay to be a lost toy, like I've really found myself, which is the movie that we now know, she willingly throws away the concept of going off with Woody, and it's not even up for discussion. She goes off with another kid, and then Woody, without his voice box, is worried and goes over by the trash specifically and is picked back up by his kid.
And you can't attach that to the current film. So many...
I know.
The rest of it was also other things. And there's a lot of sort of... I don't know, if you're a writer, you don't always have the whole thing figured out. And sometimes you attack it from the front door, and sometimes you attack it from the back door. Sometimes you come in through the side door. And so there was a lot of like, what are some of the harsh truths that might happen for a toy in the back of this? Like, what if, you know, and so one of them was, what if she's sworn off kids, but then the right one comes along? And that seemed, in theory, a very valid truth to, like, explore. So that was just one of the explorations.
Before we get to finding the perfect ending, which you did, what were some of the other ones that you experimented with? Tell us how some of those other reels over the years, even if it was stuff that you saw, Stephanie, before you came on, what were some of the other ways those reels ended?
There were so many different endings to it. I mean, there was the one I saw when I came on board was like they all went back to Bonnie's room and lived happily ever after was one of them. That's the main thing.
Including Bo Peep?
Including Bo Peep.
Interesting.
They all went back and lived with Bonnie. Which, you know, was unsatisfying, which is why it ended up not being the ending of the movie. And I think there was ones, where, like, Bo had taken Gabby's role a moment where they actually got Bo a kid instead of Gabby, because Gabby was just a complete villain and had been taken out at that point. I mean, there were so many different iterations. And I think really come to the core idea of who you are when you suffered loss, and realizing that you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to have the perfect kid. You don't have to have the perfect voice box. You don't have to have all this perfection. You can be flawed and you can be a mess and you can find your place in the world. I think for me anyway, unlocking that idea is kind of like what helped build towards that ending.
I'm curious about those final moments when it's Buzz that finally comes back around and says that she'll be okay. Yeah. And, you know, Woody thinks that he's talking about Bo Peep, but, you know, he's really talking about Bonnie. When did that moment enter into
the
mix?
Late.
Yeah.
All that kind of massaging. We always knew it had to be a goodbye, and how do you play that goodbye? And that just took a lot of massaging.
And I think Andrew was really helpful with that, too, because I think that, you know, the Brain Trust especially is so invested in the Toy Story movie, and I think having them say goodbye in a weird, strange way was emotionally hard for everyone at Pixar to kind of see that. So I think, like...
Yeah, not everybody was happy about it.
Yeah.
Really?
Well,
I mean, without naming names, what were some of the dissenting points of view?
It's not like there was a fight. It's just that nobody...
What was the downside of it?
Well, some people don't like being unhappy.
Yeah.
There's people that go to movies just to be happy.
And to have right. loss, yeah. I mean, but I think that's a loss.
I'm not one of them.
Technically, isn't it a bittersweet win for everyone?
Actually, but there's
like all characters.
There's a lot of people that don't like bittersweet in their cereal, you know? It's like, so. Yeah.
And I think it was just so defining to so many people that it was just like, oh, like you can't break up the band.
It tends to be that it's not so much that nobody doesn't want you to do it. It's just how they're thinking
Completely.
It will be done.
Right.
Is off-putting to them, and you haven't convinced them there's a way to thread that needle where it will be not only satisfying, but somewhat of an epiphany of truth that you just weren't ever keen to until it's executed right.
Well, and I think also the process of, like, you know, figuring out how to thread that needle and get everyone on board is what actually makes it work and makes it better at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, you pulled off something rare that all the characters, even the person that we thought was the antagonist... Like, all the characters have a win. It's just not the victory they expected.
Exactly, which makes it all the more truthful and more like life. It's never exactly how you expect.
We're going to take questions from the crowd in a moment, but before we do, it's always interesting to hear, what was your toughest scene? What was the scene that you came back to over and over, sweating it out, banging your head against the wall, how are we going to solve this? And what was the creative solution?
The ending.
Yeah?
I would say that ending... took us the most amount of time and was really hard. That and when Bo and Woody meet for the first time after they've been apart, like those two were kind of like the big emotional pillars that we had to hit and had to get them right.
Andrew?
The whole movie.
So cheers just that to
one,
that.
Just that one scene of the whole movie. All right, good stuff. We're going to take a question two from the crowd. Right there, you, sir. You have a question? The question was in regards to Combat Carl and the missed high fives. And, you know, you're in a digital realm, but you're doing this on the page. And it's hard to get that kind of pacing and comedic timing. And you didn't lean on it too hard. You just kept it subtle enough that it's funny.
Well, the truth is you didn't see all the failed attempts where we did try too hard. And it was too funny. And we did last too long. And that's the luxury we have of time, is that we can keep... refining it until it's just at the right fighting weight. But I think if you were to visit us at any point during most of the movies, you'd think we were making something really bad. Like, our stuff's bad for a lot longer before it's good.
It's worth it. Right there, you, ma'am. The question was regards to, it almost goes to the class struggle you were talking about Forky identifying with being trash and value versus worth were very deep subjects to put into a children's movie, but you did it so eloquently. What were the challenges of getting that in there?
Well, I mean, we went on a deep philosophical dive with Forky, and I'm probably going to bore you all to tears here, but I think, like, a touchstone was kind of... Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and kind of this idea that if you don't have purpose, you don't have real meaning in your life. And because trash really has no purpose, Forky is essentially, for the entire movie, looking for meaning in life and purpose. And when you find your purpose and how you can serve, that's when you find who you really are in the world.
And that also applies to Woody, of course.
Completely.
Because his purpose was kind of leaving, as he's not the number one toy anymore as well.
Yeah.
Another question. What could you tell me about the process of a script landing on the blacklist, which is very difficult to explain?
Yeah, I mean, I was largely out of my hands. I wrote the script, and it went out as a spec script, and it didn't sell. And I was like, oh, it's all dead. But it made the executives a vote on the blacklist and the best unproduced screenplays of the year, and it made that. And that's actually what launched my career. So we live in a wonderful world where I got a career off a script that never got made.
Did it still get made?
It could still get made, definitely. It's had many times up at bat, but that's the nature of our business, so yeah. We'll see.
All right, another question. You, sir, in the black shirt. Any advice for somebody that's moving to America, that's a film fan, that's working on their own independent film? Don't worry, we're almost out of time for our Q&A, but no pressure whatsoever on you in putting this into a short, codified answer. It would seem like the characters in the movie, right? Continue the struggle, no matter how difficult.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm trying to find the optimistic way of saying it, it's going to be a lot of either rejection or people that don't understand what you're trying to do. And I'm trying to summate this.
It goes back to your Mighty Mouse years.
You got to be able to, all right, I'm going to take the positive side of this. Nobody can stop you from creating. People can not give you money. People can say they don't like something. People can say you shouldn't do something. But nobody can stop you from being creative. And if you are, it's because you've somehow decided that you need permission from somebody else or something else. But the truth is, if you really have the wherewithal, nobody can stop you from writing that script, from getting that idea onto paper or even onto film. Frankly, with iPhones now, I don't know what can really stop you. But, and it sounds like you don't have that problem, so I think that's going to be to your benefit. Great if that helps open doors, but just don't let any rejection or dry spells slow you down.
And hold on to just creating and what that means and how that brings joy and satisfaction and just being able to express yourself in that way. Because I think focusing on results will kill you in anything.
I think that's fantastic advice and a good place to stop. I guess last question would be, could there be a Toy Story 5? I could have sworn one of the legs broke off on the fall of one of the lambs when they fell in the store.
The honest answer, there are no plans, but the honest answer is you never know.
You never know. Is there anything else coming up for either of you that you want to tell us about in the near future that you didn't mention earlier?
I've been doing a lot of TV, so there's a lot of episodes of things that I'm directing that are slowly sneaking their way out into the TV screens.
Could there ever be a WALL-E sequel?
There technically could be. I will have nothing to do with it.
All right. Good to know. Well, all I can say is you guys did a heck of a job. You've been very generous with your time. Give it up for Andrew and Stephanie.
Thank you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to screenwriters Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom for being so generous with their time when they came down to chat about their latest film, Toy Story 4. Also, don't forget to check out the massive 1917 issue of Backstory Magazine coming out in just about a week. It features four great cover stories that include co-writer Christy Wilson Cairns, 1917 stars Dean Charles Chapman and George McKay, plus editor Lee Smith. There's a ton of other fantastic TV, film, and storytelling-based interviews in issue 40, including the Safdie brothers on Uncut Gems, Rian Johnson on Knives Out, and so much more. So I hope you'll check out the table of contents over at backstory.net in the next week, right as we publish. And while you're there, you could purchase a single issue and even use coupon code 1917 to save $5 off a one-year subscription to Backstory, so thanks for considering subscribing. Your support is greatly appreciated. Of course, you could test drive us by reading the free issue over at backstory.net on a desktop or laptop or via our iPad app, so you've got plenty of options to read us, and I hope you'll dive in. And while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll also check out our sponsor, screencraft.org. You can enter their screenwriting fellowship program, but get your application in soon because they're all due by February 29th, 2020. And when you apply, don't forget to use coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, that's letter Q, the letter A, podcast, to save 10% on your application. So thanks for visiting our sponsor, screencraft.org. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2019. All rights reserved. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay all of my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.